WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're about to find out what Howard Hesseman is like in front of a radio microphone when he's not playing the role of rock disc jockey Dr. Johnny Fever. Johnny Fever was the morning drive man in the TV sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati. It premiered in 1978. From there, Hesseman moved to the TV series One Day at a Time, where he played an architect who married the character played by the star of the show, Bonnie Franklin. Now Hesseman stars in the Wednesday night comedy series Head of the Class. He plays the history teacher Charlie Moore. In keeping with Hesseman's anti-authority image, this teacher is always trying to get his honor students to recognize that there's more to life than getting good grades. You may have also seen Howard Hesseman in the films Steelyard Blues, Dr. Detroit, and This is Spinal Tap. Here's a scene from an episode of Head of the Class. Hesseman is directing a student production of Grease, but his students are afraid that performing will take away precious time from their studies, so Hesseman has to talk them into auditioning.
Can I see your paper there, Maria?
Sure.
A minus, huh? It's an excellent paper, Maria.
Yeah, so?
It's really very good.
Thank you.
How did that make you feel?
Fine.
Okay. Try this. You were terrific! I mean, you were just
wasn't that marvelous?
Really, I just love you.
Wow.
How does that make you feel?
Fantastic.
Well, that is show business.
I'll do it.
Okay, who else?
Howard Hesseman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Head of the Class is, in a way, a reversal of the type of school shows that television had on, say, in the 1960s, because in this case, the students are the overachievers, and you, as the teacher, is the one who's trying to loosen them up a little bit.
Yeah, that's accurate.
But yet you're the authority figure, which most TV viewers aren't used to seeing you as.
Well, I guess they're not. I'm not used to seeing myself that way. But, you know, when you say it's sort of a reversal of the 60s, so are the 80s in a sickening sense. A reversal of the 60s in which, you know, nobody wants to take responsibility for much of anything, but they want all the rewards and accoutrements of a responsible life. Thus, the planet is sort of slowly dying off. At least that's my sort of pinhead view this morning.
When you were offered the part of the teacher on Head of the Class, did you immediately accept?
No. When I was first approached by the two men who had the show in mind, Michael Elias and Rich Eustace, they were simply discussing it in terms of a concept, and my position was that I would wait and see something on the page. I wanted to see what kind of writing they had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had definite ideas based on the pilot script that I did read, and we had long discussions regarding those ideas, and I felt reasonably assured that, I like to think of myself as a realist, some portion of those ideas would be incorporated in subsequent shows if the pilot were to be sold and we were going to go on the air.
What are the parts of the character that you think of as yours, character dimensions that you added that weren't in the way the character was initially conceived?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer, Terry. I think in television, particularly where everything is done in such a, I don't want to say a shorthand manner, but a shortcut manner, actors sort of are the character. It's not as though you're given a well-delineated character that's been tried and tested over a period of time, like, you know, stage characters, or someone who's a character that's had the benefit of a long period of development, of gestation and development in the writer's mind. The character is created, and once it's sold, there is this enormous rush to make things work in a very tight time schedule with as tight a budget as possible. I mean, some of these things are certainly true in movies and in stage work as well. But I think more and more, because of the voracious appetite of television as a medium, writers depend on personality quirks of the actor to delineate character. And in the long run, my feeling as an actor is that there is no character. There's me, and I'm limited by what this character says and does according to the text. But I have to, in a sense, and this all gets so metaphysical and pompous, I can hardly stand to say these things. In the end, you just end up using facets of yourself to support a more limited version of yourself, a more limited version being someone whose actions and words are prescribed by the text. I mean, in other words, the character is always less than the actor portraying him.
Were you anxious to get back into TV after after One Day at a Time and after KRP?
No, I don't think I was ever anxious to get into TV. Even now, on an almost daily basis, there's a certain sense of, to quote a friend, joyful dread each morning. you know, I like to work. I like the actor's work. I love doing it. But there is something about television, and particularly series production, that saps me of the will to live.
But other than that, it's great. Well, where does in the joyful dread, what's the dread part of the equation?
Well, most of television is so predictable. I mean, that's not limited to television either. I mean, a great many stage plays that we see now and a great many movies are so predictable in terms of the plot, in terms of the action, in terms of what little character revelation and delineation occurs. You know where they're going. You're not surprised. And I suppose, you know, I have these standards that are relatively impossible for me or anyone else to meet, in part because I can't define them. So, but I'm just, for the most part, disappointed when I look at television, particularly network television.
Are there issues that you'd like to take on in Head of the Class that you feel you can't because it's television?
Well, I think they can be taken on, but it's not that kind of show. It's not my show. I didn't create it. I'm not in charge. I don't have the final say. I think there are issues that the show frequently touches upon. It would be my wish that we would actually delve into those issues a little more deeply and actually investigate how specific issues in the latter half of the 20th century affect both highly intelligent and sensitive high school students, other students as well, and adults or people who pass for adults. You know, an issue, it seems to me, shouldn't just be used as a hook for the viewer's attention. If you're going to actually raise a relevant issue that is relevant to the lives of the people watching the show, then I think you have a responsibility to discuss that issue, to look at that issue, to turn it and look at various sides of it, various facets of it, and see how it affects people in a real way. Otherwise, don't bring up real issues. It would seem to me, and this is only my opinion, and I'm sorry if it sounds as though I'm demeaning the work of other people, specifically writers, but it seems to me that if you don't really investigate a genuine issue, then you're simply saying surface is enough. We don't need any substance. And I'd rather leave that to the Republican Party.
Howard Hessman is my guest. Do you find that television viewers' preconceptions of you vary according to who you're playing on TV? You know, when you were Johnny Fever, did they think of you as being someone who was always high and a real, you know, anti-authority kind of figure? Then when you were on One Day at a Time as someone who was going to marry Bonnie Franklin, and now as the teacher and Head of the Class, do people have a different idea of who you are based on who you're playing?
Absolutely. Sometimes I think of it as sort of quaint, and sometimes it's terrifying. Many people's seeming inability to differentiate between character that you're playing on television and who you really are. Of course, this flies in the face of what I was saying 8-10 minutes ago about in television, the actor sort of becomes the character, or some facet of the actor is exaggerated and becomes a key element of the character. But I also feel as though that's a problem that exists largely for those people and not for me.
But what are some of the different ways people have seen you? Different preconceptions people have had on you, had about you, depending on which role you've been playing at the time.
Well, it was very strange during the production of WKRP. We had extraordinary support from the radio broadcast industry, far more so than CBS TV. Thanks to radio, people knew that we were being bounced around the schedule like a ping pong ball for the entire 4 years. Radio people really followed the show and let their listeners know about it. And at the same time, radio people were very quick to talk about inaccuracies and inconsistencies in the studio setting of the show. And, you know, the only defense that one can offer is we're not doing a show about how radio works. We're doing a show about a group of people who happen to work together at a radio station. There is this poetic license that we're taking. But in terms of a specific character, yeah, people thought I was really loose, that I was always looking to get loaded, that I was some kind of party animal on my last legs, but I was going to go down, at full tilt boogie speed. Hardly true. That had happened years before. And as a teacher, playing a teacher now, a number of teachers comment to me that they really enjoy the show. They like the values espoused by the show, and I'm very pleased with that. But I do have some contention with those teachers and students who refer to the realistic quality of the show, that it's very much like their class, that they have students just like that.
And, of course, you don't think it's realistic at all, right?
I don't think it's terribly realistic, but then I haven't been in high school for 30 years or so. I don't know anymore. I've been doing television now pretty steadily for 10 years, and perhaps my notion of reality is severely warped.
Did your role grow on KRP in Cincinnati as your character became more popular?
I think so, and at the same time, in an attempt to be fair to Hugh Wilson, the man who created WKRP and almost single-handedly wrote probably 50, 60 of the 96 shows that we did, Hugh always conceived of that show as a gang comedy, as an ensemble piece, and he was very careful to give everyone their due. At the same time, realistically speaking, when you're in the clutches of a network who is in the clutches of many sponsors, and profit seems to be the major determining factor with those folks, they go with what seems to work. And Dr. Johnny Fever seemed to work with the audience. I didn't have any major complaints, but then again, I wasn't playing another character. But I felt that by the same token, the other characters were well served throughout the 4 years of that show. There was a conscious attempt to both feature Johnny and Lonnie Anderson's character, Jennifer, but not to the detriment of development of those other characters. I felt that everybody on that show got a fair shot. I'm grateful that the audience responded to my character, and at the same time, trying almost in vain to remember your question, yeah, the character did grow as the show went along, because Hugh and the writing staff that he had chosen were particularly committed to a collaborative approach.
You'd be great doing speed raps on the radio. I'm just thinking about that.
Yeah, well, put me in front of a mic and it gets all crazy, you know what I mean?
who did you pattern the disc jockey on who you played? Did you have an image in mind? I know, yeah. You were a disc jockey for a really brief period of time, around 6 months.
I was, and I welcome this opportunity to say this on radio. Repeatedly in talking with print interviewers, I would try to stress the fact that I had been a professional actor for several years prior to my brief and humiliating stint as a radio personality. I put quotes around that.
What was humiliating about it?
Well, I think when you're doing radio, you like to feel that people are listening and enjoying what they hear. And in my case, what little feedback occurred indicated to me that wasn't necessarily the case. But it was great fun, and I patterned Fever after my sense of myself as a disc jockey, but just with a little more, with a sufficient degree of success that was invisible to me. I mean, I thought, this guy is better than he thinks he is. He's really committed to doing a good job, but he's messed up any number of times along the way. But he's still good because of his commitment. Beyond that, there were a number of radio personalities who were good friends of mine in San Francisco in the 60s, and I think little bits and pieces of them would float through Fever from time to time, sort of little ghost visits. The late Tom Donahue, Big Daddy Tom Donahue, was sort of the father of progressive rock and roll radio in America, was a close friend. His wife, Rachel, Ms. Ray, who's still on the air here in L.A., is a terrific radio personality. There were any number of people, Bob McClay, the names have floated away like a lot of my life. Under the pressure of questions, but just little elements of different people would occur to me.
I mentioned we talk about other aspects of your work, and that reminds me that it was a year or two ago, very late one Friday night, I saw a part of a made-for-TV movie that you starred in as a rapist. And I think it must have been made before KRP in Cincinnati. I don't remember the date of it. But I figure after KRP, you might not have been able to get a role like that, playing the heavy, because people liked you so much that it might have been unbelievable
difficult
for them. Yeah. And not hard for you to play, but, you know, people are always casting with audience expectations in mind.
Precisely. And quite the contrary. I did that role, I think, midway between the second and third production seasons of WKRP.
Oh.
I've been very fortunate, Terry, in that I had a sense that Fever was going to work for an audience. I mean, in my mind, it was clear that I was going to make him as different from any television character, a sitcom character, as I possibly could. And I also felt that when the show did hit and was moderately successful in that first season, in spite of scheduling problems with CBS, that it was important for me immediately to do roles, to do characters as far removed from Fever as I could possibly get people to agree to. And in the second hiatus, in the second summer period, the film to which you refer, which was called Victims with Kate Nelligan,
mm-hmm, that's right,
was an example of that. It wasn't a great role. It wasn't all that flashy, but it was certainly interesting and considerably different from The Good Doctor. And that sort of thing has always appealed to me. I mean, this sounds like the kind of conversation that every actor has, and perhaps there's a reason for that, Terry. I like to expand my horizons. I want to show people I can, you know. But it's the truth. You get tired of doing the same character day in and day out.
Did you have a hippie image when you first started acting?
Well, when I first started acting?
Yeah.
No, I was in the second grade. Actually, I think I probably actually started acting when I was about 3 years old. I was trying to act normal. But I became a professional actor in San Francisco with the Committee, an improvisational, satirical, political improvisational review company in 1965. And I looked fairly normal. I wasn't inside. But I think I had just done a play, so I'd cut my hair. I looked sort of straight, kind of square, as we used to say. And that changed as the years went by, but I would come up with a role that would force me to cut my hair. Yeah, yes, I wore a lot of tie-dye and bright velvet English trousers and patchwork boots, and as often as not, my hair was longer than my neck. I had that image, and I just thought, you know, sort of in the mindset of the times, I'll cut my hair as a celebration of something wonderful. And somebody would say, here's a great role, and it's going to pay this much money, and give me those scissors. I was ready to go. You know, I always felt that in some sense, a professional actor, you know, you might as well tattoo for rent on your forehead.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. In the film Steelyard Blues, made in 1973, Donald Sutherland, Peter Boyle, John Savage, they play the misfits, they play the outsiders, and you play the suit, you play the establishment.
I have photographs of myself taken the day before I cut my hair to get the look of that character.
Oh.
And the film, incidentally, was made in 1971,
oh, okay.
I believe. 70 or 71, and released about a year later. But let's put it this way. I had hair that was close to between my shoulder blades and a long mustache, and I took all that off and discovered within the first week that none of my clothing worked any longer. When I was on the street, I can't really tell the story on the radio because it's not going to carry very well, but basically, people who normally would have, you know, winked or given me a high sign or something in a surreptitious manner.
Sure, passed you a joint or something.
Yeah, basically, many of us at that point in time walked with our eyes pretty much toward the ground for fear of tripping and meeting the ground suddenly face first. And when you saw somebody, you know, you kind of traveled up over the ankle bone, the knee bone, the thigh bone, up and checked out their face, and then it was just random head, eye, neck movements from there. And I would discover people coming up and at about chest level, they were still smiling, and then they would see this haircut. It would get all different. There was a willful attempt to avert their eyes. And I got very quickly, probably within 2 or 3 days, that I appeared to be either on leave from boot camp or an incredibly crude undercover agent. And it was time to go buy some new clothes because this, you know, rock and roll drag didn't work anymore.
Well, speaking of undercover agents, didn't you once sell an ounce of grass to an undercover agent in the early 60s?
He begged me.
He begged
me endlessly. That's all I can say. The man was destitute. I knew he was an undercover agent, but just as a human being, and perhaps you had to be in San Francisco in 1963 to understand this, I wanted to help him.
Well,
it was 2 ounces, and in fact, at the preliminary hearing in San Francisco County Court, there was only 1 ounce offered in evidence. You draw your own conclusions.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Now, you know what they always say about how things are going to affect your later career. You got a 3-year sentence for this, which was suspended, but you had to serve 90 days in prison.
Yeah, that was before it was hip to be arrested for drugs.
Well, did this ever interfere with your acting career? Did you ever have to fill out an application there or anywhere else that said, have you ever been arrested?
No, I filled out many of those. I served my probationary period. In fact, I had 3 years of probation, and at the end of 2 years, my probation officer recommended, and the court wisely saw fit, to terminate my probation, since I'd clearly turned into an upstanding citizen and was doing my best to ridicule every holy institution in the Western world 6 nights a week on stage. But I was making a living, so I fit in somehow. Having your record expunged, at least in California, means that you can legally answer the question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? No. I think what it really means is that they cross out your name somewhere in the files, but it's still clear that you were once convicted of a felony, but that you can legally say you weren't. It's never been any real problem for me. I'm sure with the broadcast of this interview, that will change. On the other hand, I don't think Jerry Falwell and his ilk would dare start burning people at the cross, but who knows? It's never really been a problem. The committee was not the sort of theater group that would look upon me with disdain for that sort of activity.
Right.
In fact, whether I did that or not was of little consequence to them.
Are you ever surprised when you wake up in the morning that you yes. have started?
Oh.
Not what I meant. But that you who got started on the committee satirizing everything ended up a TV star.
Yeah, I, yes, I've turned into one of my own targets. but many of us have been saying that for a long time. We became the people we used to satirize. It's terrifying to consider. And then on the other hand, you can say, well, of course I was young when I... When I did all that, it's all changed. Now my values are different. I don't... some of them are, some of them aren't. If none of them changed, I would assume that you know, I was the victim of some real... what do we want to say? Arrested development. And I'm not a registered Republican. I don't think that's the case.